Hi everyone, so this is a full length interview this episode. So Kobe was lucky enough to spend some time with Dee Watkins, the writer of the brand new book, The Wire, The Complete Visual History.
Yeah, so Dee Watkins is a television writer. So he wrote one episode of We Own the City, the kind of follow-up companion piece to The Wire. And he's written his own books, but he's also interviewed a lot of people for The Complete Visual History of The Wire, which is a fantastically gorgeous coffee table book.
Yeah, it's lovely.
And it looks, yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. And for you lucky listeners, we are going to be running a competition so you can win a signed version. It should be signed by Dee and David Simon. And if you want to hear more about that, do follow us on social media. We're at The Wire Stripped on Instagram and Twitter.
When you walk through the garden, you gotta watch your back. Well, I beg your pardon. Walk the straight and narrow track. When you walk with Jesus, he's gonna save your soul. Just gotta keep the devil way down in the hole. He got the fire and the fury.
Well, obviously we're a podcast about The Wire, Dee, so we have to ask you, have you seen The Wire?
You know, it's funny because I did not see The Wire when it aired on HBO. However, I feel like I saw The Wire more than most people. I felt like I saw. I'm a big Wire fan. The show changed my life in so many different ways before I had any affiliation with HBO, any affiliation with David Simon and the crew. The Wire, it's just it opened all types of. It gave me so many different things to think about in my own existence and my own reality, because I was living in Baltimore. I know these people. Like, I know the real Stringer Bell. I know Mr. Chim Farmer. I know I grew up with a bunch of Barksdales. I know the real Marlowe Stanfield, who's really not a Stanfield. He's a Bateman. His big brothers are Stanfields. He's a Bateman. Like, I talked to him on the phone a couple of days ago. Like, I know these people. So to have it on air and these people all around the world tapping to these stories was just mind blowing for me, and I'm truly honored to be a part of that legacy.
I mean, let's talk a bit about that, because it's impressive. I mean, I tell people, and I think many people have had the same experience, where The Wire and this kind of this new, you know, was part of the revolution. You know, it drew the line in the sand between old TV styles and new TV styles. You know, the long form narrative content versus the procedural one episode. You've done, it doesn't matter if you miss 10 in a season, if you catch five of the other ones, you'll be happy. But, you know, with The Wire and this, you know, a lot of the TV shows you see on Netflix now wouldn't work. They wouldn't work in the, they have that long form narrative now, don't they? And they've seen that The Wire can carry that through per season over multiple seasons. And that for me is mind blowing in itself. But then also the fundamental stories that it tells in The Wire, that the drug trade is not a fair war. You know, the war on drugs is not a fair war. It's, you know, think about rehabilitation rather than incarceration. The school system being the source of where a lot of problems go wrong for people, underprivileged people. And if you can support those people, then you're a long way down the line. The journalists, journalism, and their, what they have to show, what their role is in the show, in life. You know, these kind of lenses really opened my eyes. I say lens nicely because it's like a magnifying glass. It just showed you exactly what was going on underneath it. And for me, that was just like a fundamental, okay, I see this now. But for you, it sounds like it was a whole life change. You literally, you know, 180'd your life and you went down a different route as a result of this.
Yeah, because it was an explosion of perspective. And that was also something that we didn't have in television before The Wire. We never had a show key in on the diversity of thought and then where those different perspectives intersect. So like in traditional television, or if I can say before The Wire, cops are cops, and cops are cops, and cops are pretty much only good and only do good things, and cops chase the bad guys and they lock the bad guys up, and the only time they meet is when they are arresting a person in the end. We don't even see what happens with court, but in real life some of the bad guys are some of the best people in the world and the best people for the city, and some of the cops are the worst people in the world and the worst people of the city, and they don't just intersect. And when it's time to arrest or at the end of the investigation, they might bump into each other in the same coffee shop. They might date a mutual woman. Like all of these different, all of these, the way these worlds intertwine was something that a lot of people on television never thought about. And it only could have taken place in Baltimore because Baltimore is a very unique city. It has a population that kind of floats above or around 600,000 people. However, you can move to town tomorrow and potentially be at a party with the mayor next week. The connection between a transplant or a person from poverty or a person who never thought about being in any type of political arena can pretty much almost trip, fall, and land right next to power. Most places you gotta go, You gotta do a little boot licking and a little research and kissing up and have some type of status to get close to power. In this city, you may bump into power in the market, and that's what made The Wire so special, because the people who did, you know, if you look at Stringer Bell, who was you know, again based on a guy named Chen Farmer, he's a street guy, but he was this. There's no unique storyline on how he got so tied in with Clay Davis. It was almost instant because, and no one questioned it because it almost looked natural. You think, oh, the crooked politician and the crooked whatever, but no. In the real world, you don't walk out of the project tower and then go into business with a big time politician with a huge, huge black legacy without some type of story to build on upon how that connection took place. But in Baltimore, it's natural and it's simple and it kind of works like that. So I think just understanding my place, you know, I grew up just like the kids on season 4. I went to Baltimore City Public Schools, the big teacher turnaround, big teacher shortage, no foundation of a traditional education, and forced with the task of figuring out how to make it up out of that, you know. And still, with that being my pedigree and my background, I've still had connections to power.
You've come out of the system that we've seen, you know, the boys of summer go through, Dookie, Naaman, Michael, and Randy. And, you know, the end of season 4 is heartbreaking for two of those kids, at least, and uncertain for the other two, right? So where were you at the end of, you know, that year for yourself? What were you... What position were you if that had been your season 4?
If that would have been my season 4, it would have started with my big brother telling me that I need to go to school for computers. And he never said programming, he never said building like apps or anything like that. He used to just always say that one day the world is going to be ran by computers. And I used to be like, computers cost like $10,000 and nobody has one. And he's like, no, everybody's going to have them. So, you know, I studied hard and I got accepted into some good universities. And then my brother was murdered. And when he was murdered, initially I didn't go to school. I stayed home to try to deal with just the grief and the pain that came with that. And then I tried to go to school, and it was like culture shock, because if we're gonna like compare it to season 4, it's that feeling of when those kids went to the restaurant and they never had that kind of that cultural experience. When the kids in the classroom had won the test and Colvin took them out to the steakhouse to celebrate, and no one wanted to eat or really do anything because it was like a culture shock. That was my experience in college. It was culture shock. So I came home and then I went right into the streets like my brother did. So my season 4 would have ended as learning how to be the next Marlowe is how my season would have ended. So it wasn't optimistic, but I'm fortunate and blessed and lucky enough to make it out of that.
I mean, the fact that you went to college does set you apart from the trajectory that we feel, you know, set up for the rest of the kids, or most of the kids in season four. What was that like? What was that kind of process like for yourself?
It was
going to college in the first place.
So to talk about Baltimore again, just so you know, people who watch the show can get a real understanding. Baltimore is extremely segregated, so you can grow up in Baltimore City and not have any white peers until you are old enough to get a job. So there weren't white people on my basketball team. There was no white people, you know, to the people who went to church. They didn't go to church with white people. The only white people you would come across would be police officers and some teachers and maybe social workers. So you don't have like, you don't have access to a lot of different cultures. And keep in mind, this is the days before social media. There's no Facebook and Instagram and these things, no Twitter. These things don't exist. It's all outside experiences. So I was a person from a hyper black culture that went to what you would call a PWI, predominantly white institution. And not only was there a cultural difference in what I subscribe to and what I know and what I believed in, but then, you know, also, just again, like thought and like my lens through the world. They didn't see police how I saw police. They didn't see the slave trade how I saw the slave trade. They didn't see an American experience how I saw American experience. And it was very difficult for me. And I didn't last long initially. Yeah. The first time I went a couple of months and then I dropped out. And I ended up going back to school years later. But I was like, yo, this isn't for me. Let me get away from this. And it didn't work out.
I mean, it sounds like what you experienced was an extreme version of what a lot of people I know who went to university, what we call college here in the UK, went, you know, it wasn't so much of a culture shock in terms of the cultural makeup of people. Now, a black guy went to predominantly white, up until I was like 11, it was very much a mixed race area I lived in, and then went a bit whiter. And then when I went to university, it was back to multicultural again. But we had people, you know, white people who didn't know any black guys or Indian or Pakistani or, you know, kind of thing. But it wasn't the cultural shock they were facing. It was more the expectation, the weight of expectation on them. It was suddenly like dawning. You know, some of these kids were the brightest in their school and they were trained, the whole life was set up to be a doctor. But when they got to university and they didn't have the guardrails around them, things changed. But it sounds like what you're experiencing is like, you know, a super extreme version of that, where it's a fundamental mind shift, really. And I mean, I can understand. I know people who dropped out for smaller reasons. I say smaller in quote unquote. So I can fully understand where your head is at. I can fully empathize with where you were in your life at that point.
I was a good enough student to, I graduated from Johns Hopkins University, which is like one of the top schools in America. So I got into some really, really, really good schools. Like I wasn't a disruptive kid. Maybe I ran my mouth a little too much, which serves me well in my career now, but you know, didn't pay any dividends in the classroom, but I studied really, really hard and I paid attention. I listened to my elders. So intellectually I could play ball, but socially I couldn't because I didn't know I didn't know there was a difference between a dinner fork and a salad fork. I didn't know anything about rock music, punk rock music, soft rock music. I didn't know about hacky sacky. Like this is all of these things I never heard of. There was never in my neighborhood. We rode dirt bikes. We played basketball. We listened to, you know, like Jay-Z and Nas and we wore baggy clothes. We didn't wear like boat shoes and things like that. So it's wild looking at culture now. The way popular culture has just become like everybody's a sneakerhead. Everybody likes this music. Everybody follows this trend. Everybody does that. But back in the day, it was the world was extremely divided. And if I'm walking on campus with braids in my hair and gold teeth, they're looking at me like I'm crazy. Like, yo, what world is this guy's from? A different world. And that's
literally what, an alien.
Yeah, you look like a gold tooth alien. So it was different. But I'm in a way, I'm kind of happy that we're starting to accept other people's cultures now, because it's better for everybody. Like, we have to understand that our experience is not the only experience. And I think the show did a great job at amplifying that idea.
So tell us what you're doing now then, D.
I'm a very fortunate guy. My husband, a father, New York Times bestselling author of a few books. Black Boy Smile was number 5. This The Wire book with David Simon will be number 6. I've ghostwritten books for multiple NBA players. Worked on a few television shows and documentaries, including HBO's We Own the City and The Slow Hustle. And currently just working on a lot of cool projects now with some pretty interesting people. One of them is Mike Africa, and helping to tell the story of MOVE, which was the only time in American history where a police department bombed a family and killed 6 people.
And it's called MOVE, sorry.
Yeah, as you want to know the story, there's a documentary called 40 Years a Prisoner on HBO.
You talked about Black Boy Smile being your 5th book, and that's one of the reasons we wanted to bring you on to talk. Can you tell us about that? Because that's available now. That's on Amazon and other good book places. Can you tell us about that, D?
Black Boy Smile, I think, is an important piece of art, because for people listening to this podcast, if you want to do a deep dive of what happens to a character like Michael from season 4, a character like Dookie from season 4, or Randy or Naaman, if you want to do a deep dive into their world and the lens they learn masculinity through, then the book gives you that. It gives you a real glimpse of how we are taught to be men, how destructive and violent that can be, and what a person has to do to unlearn some of the toxic traits that we pick up trying to survive in an American city. So it's very, very important to understand that, you know, before we judge a person for participating in dangerous or violent acts, we must first acknowledge or understand where it came from. Because if we can get to the root of the problems, then we can do great work for the next generation to make sure we're not passing on toxic traits and things like that. And that book, I try my best to tackle that flawed masculinity conversation in hopes of being a better person and helping the people who I mentor and who I work with become better people as well.
And how does that mentoring work, and what kind of results you're seeing, and what kind of, you know, feedback you're getting from those systems?
So the hardest part is getting people from my generation. Now I'm talking 80s babies, and you know, we're fathers and grandfathers. We're fathers and grandfathers now. Yeah. And some young grandfathers, but we're grandfathers.
Well, I was listening to the HBO The Wire at 20 podcast, and Method Man talking about being a grandfather. I'm like, what?
Yo, right. Exactly.
I heard your voice in there as well.
Yeah, so for sure. And I think that it's extremely important to for people from my generation, the 80s babies who are fathers, you know, to be honest. And that's the hard part, to say I wasn't always the toughest person in the world, and people hurt my feelings, and people made me cry, and I've had insecurities, and I struggle with them insecurities, and I battle with them things, and I deserve love, and I want love. Even if I've done terrible things, I deserve to be loved. I want to be loved. I want to love people. I want to be honest. And when I'm wrong, I want to yell that I'm wrong, and I want to be held accountable. And it's very, very hard in a hyper-masculine culture when you grow up in a country where you don't have a trust fund and you're dealing with racism, and the only valuable thing you have outside of whatever money you were able to grind up is resiliency. Resiliency is currency here. So in order to be a full and complete person, a man who's able to be vulnerable, you have to sacrifice your greatest currency, which is that resiliency that allows you to say, I'm never wrong. I'm always right. I always win. You got to sacrifice that. And it's dangerous because it's all we have, but it's necessary to go to the next level and fully, fully love and be loved.
Are you aware of, did you ever watch The West Wing?
Yeah, I'm watching The West Wing now, so I'm brand new. I'm new to it.
Oh wow, how far through are you?
Like 3 episodes. please no spoilers.
we see a few why people. I'm not gonna spoil things, but there's an interesting storyline with Charlie Young and mentoring people. Charlie being the only predominant black person in the whole story. So when you get to those that kind of storyline. Drop me a line.
Yeah, I'm going to shoot you a note. I'm definitely going to shoot you a note.
So, Black Boy Smile, We Own the City, and then we've got the Wire retrospective book. I want to talk about We Own the City because this came out earlier this year, 2022, if you listen to it after 2022. This is an astonishing miniseries, right? And astonishing because it's true, astonishing because... As you said before, as you said at the start, prior to The Wire, the cops were the good guys, the bad guys were the bad guys, and there was never kind of set in stone. Here we have the cops being the worst guys, and for reasons I still don't understand, because there's a scene in, sorry, spoilers for We're in the City, there's a scene where they're kind of bragging about how much money they're making anyway. And to me, I'm like, that's a decent salary, guys. You're, without doing the criminal stuff, you're earning a decent wage.
But you know how capitalism works.
Well, yeah.
You know how it works. It's never enough. There's no such thing as a decent salary. In their minds, they're owed that, and then they're owed everything on the street, too.
Yeah.
Predator. So you think about a predator. Think about the movie Wall Street, right? Think about Gordon Gekko. You ever see Wall Street? Mm.
Yeah, greed is good.
Think about telling him he's made enough. You go knock on his door at his office. He's probably on the 80th floor. So you get in the elevator and go up to the 80th floor, knock on his door after you make it past his 12 secretaries and say, hey, buddy, you have a nice salary. He's going to try to throw you out the window.
Okay, you got me. But I mean, I thought... those salaries that they were talking about, and this was, best part of 10 years ago, I thought the police in general earned half that amount. So when they were saying they're going into hundreds of thousands, this mm-hmm. is what, guys in Silicon Valley are earning that kind of sum of money. And I, when I heard that, I was like, good. These public servants, police, doctors, nurses, teachers. Mm-hmm. I feel that nurses and teachers get slighted in this. I wish the nurses and teachers, I'm sure nurses and teachers don't get paid anywhere near as much as the police do in Baltimore. But these guys who are public servants and are looking for the greater good for everyone around them, I think they need to be rewarded. And when I heard that, I was like, okay, the police seem to be rewarded.
another thing that we have to add to that, to this conversation, is the idea of, most people don't choose cop because they want to look out for the greater good of people around them. They choose cop because that's the top option in their list of options. So they're not doing it to be heroes. They're doing it because there's benefits, there's retirement, and there's unlimited overtime if you play your cards right. And I think I think once we realize that, then we're less surprised when we see scenes like the one you saw.
You get people, because I know a lot of my friends from school went into the police force, and I don't think any of them as a kid growing up said, I want to be a police officer. But you still get those outliers who say, yeah, when I grow up, I want to be a policeman. I want to be a police officer. I want to catch the bad guys. So I agree with you to a large extent there. It tends to be other factors that does make it makes the police force more attractive as you grow up because you have that kind of support network that public servants do tend to get more than private, right?
And not to take everything from police officers, but I will say that some of them feel like they do really good work and aren't fairly compensated for it. And they feel like they deserve to be compensated more. So what we would call overtime fraud, they call getting what they feel like they deserve. And, you know, it gets tricky, but there is a large segment of people who choose cop because it's, you know, unfortunately, the only choice that they have. So they choose it, and then it doesn't take a lot of coercing for them to abuse it.
And this is what we see in We End the City, you know. And it seems to start right off, you know, when you go through training the academy, you're taught to do things right, but you know, in We End the City, as soon as you come out of the training academy, first day on the beat, almost they say, you know, just rip that shit up. You know, it's not gonna work. This is how to do it real. This is how to do it properly. And it takes the odd, it seems, I'm not sure how true this is to life, but it seems to be the odd officer who doesn't take the bribe or the extra bit. And look, that kind of stuff's human, right? And if I was in that position, we saw Herc and Carver in season one,
mm-hmm.
Who are cops, and we, you know, in season one, certainly they're both a bit bumbling idiots, aren't they? But they come across a drug bust. There's plenty of cash around. No one's going to miss it. They need to get a new car. They need to fix the car up. They need to get new windows. Hey, if I just take one of these piles of cash and put it in my vest, who's going to lose out? But then I'd be very surprised if, you know, a large portion of the police force hadn't done that. But then to take it to the extremes that we have Wayne Jenkins and his crew, where they're actively seeking this out and actively have schemes set aside to do that, then that's a different, you know, I'm not sure where the line is, but that feels different, right?
Yeah, this guy Wayne Jenkins had a whole playbook. He would wake up in the morning and jot down notes, and you know, he had grappling hooks, ski masks, hockey masks, uniform. He had male people uniforms. He had a whole operation going on, and was solely based on him feeling like he deserved to get more. You know, I think the writers of The Wire, I think they made an attempt to justify Herc and Carver in a way, because if you go back to season one, they make a drug bust and they found all of this money, and the money they bring in didn't match what they heard on The Wire, so Daniels thought they stole, and they didn't steal. Some of the cash fell out the bag and got caught, like, in the wheel well. So when they went through the car and found it, you know, Daniels, you know, talked to them like, you know better, don't do that no more, and they didn't do anything. So when they came across the drug bust again, they were just like, fuck it, I'm keeping it. and they kept it.
As long as it tallies up, and then they were going to hand in what tallies up.
And then I think the great thing the writers did with that was show that, and it's because this happens in the police force too, and I think people don't pay attention to this enough, but you can start off out of control and be an idiot, but you can grow into the position. And I feel like Carver grew into the position. Carver from season one was not Carver that was pissed off. Yeah, from season four and five, he wasn't the same guy. Herc was still an asshole, but Carver got a chance. Carver got a chance to grow into that position, and I think we're living in a time right now where we do have to learn how to give people grace and give people the room to grow, and then give them their flowers when they actually do. And I think that was just a brilliant piece of writing right there as well.
I think I love the kind of dual storylines at Herc and Carver. Like I said at the start, Carver got a higher score in his sergeant's exam. So you think, okay, so it's going to be Sergeant Carver. He's going to take point. But he was the one that didn't have the empathy. He didn't have the way of thinking. He maybe, you know, he didn't have the tutelage that Bunny Colvin had and was able to give to to Carver and his guys. You know, you see McNulty, and you know, as much as of a fuck at McNulty is, he's good police, and he knows which way's up. Even though, you know, when it comes to season five, he's doing these things, he's making these fake murders because there's a reason behind it. He wants to get the police more funds so they can do more things. So it's kind of a maligned, it's kind of a misplaced sense of justice what he's doing. But where Herc kind of runs amok is that he almost doesn't care in places. You know, he makes up Fuzzy Dunlop and he can't cover his tracks. He's got no one to back him up. When you see season five, when McNulty's going off the rails, Freeman backs him up. Freeman says, "Yeah, I know what you're doing. It's a bit wayward, but I'm gonna back you up. Let's do this properly because I know where you're going with this." I'm not sure where I'm going with this line of track, but I just like the way that Herc and Carver kind of split. And there's a lot of reasons when you look back in it. I think there's a lot of reasons why that does happen, and it's an interesting storyline. It's just the storylines that we follow there.
And coming from the street, I was in the streets. I hustled in the streets for years, and what I appreciated about anybody who's coming out of the streets, especially in Baltimore, what we appreciate about the show is that idea. Everything that looks the same is not the same. The police officer that jam your pockets and take the $300 from you in 1998 could be a whole different cop in 2005 and will approach you different. It will say a different thing. It will move in a different way. And he or she might have a partner that is even more extreme and would go completely the other way. So it's like we don't have these straight vanilla characters that all look and do the same thing. It's diverse, it's complex, it's complicated, and it hits on that idea of it not being good and bad professions, it being good and bad people.
A great example of that is Lieutenant Daniels, or Major Daniels as it gets towards the end of the show. And we spoke to Lance Reddick early on in our podcast, and he said, look, he's got some dirt and he did some dodgy stuff. And it speaks to what you're saying there. Daniels is almost like the best of them by the end of the season. But if we'd caught Daniels, you know, 5 years before, 10 years before, who knows what kind of character we would have seen going on the streets. Daniels is the one who knows how to cover the tracks when Herc, Carver and Prez go wild in the towers, right? Mm-hmm. He knows how to do these things, but also he knows how to play with Rhonda Perlman and do the legit thing and follow the chain of command and climb the ladder. So those nuances are human and exemplary to see in the show. And you know, for David Simon and the guys to say to yourself, Dee Watkins, we're doing the show, we own the city, talking about the real drug Gun Trace Task Force, will you come along and write an episode for us? What was that like?
You know, I thought I was just coming in to consult. I didn't think I was going to get an opportunity to write an episode because David and George, Pelicanos, George Pelicanos is like one of the best novelists ever, straight up. He do his thing in television. George Pelicano is one of the best novelists, one of the best writers ever. David Simon's a certified genius. People already know his body of work. His nonfiction books are the best. Some of the best I've ever read. So I'm thinking I'm coming in to just learn from these guys. They're the OGs. So I got my pen and my pad, and I'm just taking notes because one day I want to be as good as a showrunner and a producer like David. I want to be as good as a writer, a storyteller, a producer, a showrunner like George. I want to learn from them. And David's like, okay, you're going to do number three. And like on like maybe like the second day, like you're going to do number three. And I'm like, oh, bet. And then I never walked away from a challenge. So I knew that I was going to have to learn their style and get the tone. So I watched The Deuce. I rewatched The Wire. But I also was a lot of people don't know this, but I'm one of the people who broke that case I was a journalist, and I'm one of the people I'm one of the people that broke the actual case on.
So you're working with Justin Fenton.
Before Fenton, Fenton was with the Baltimore Sun. Fenton's with the Baltimore Sun, and Fenton covered these cops, but I covered the cop. I was the first one to cover the cop as being crooked. So Fenton might have covered it from a misconduct settlement that got paid out to a resident, but I'm in the community like profiling and featuring people who saying this cop steals, this cop takes money, this cop is a racist, this cop is. So I'm publishing those stories. So when David got in the room, so David said, well, one of his reasons he wanted me to work on the show was because he already knew I was writing about this stuff since like 2013, 2014. So it wasn't brand new for me. So so that was like my affiliation with it. And then I think the new guys in the writers' room was Justin. They optioned his book, and then it was me as the person who had all of that early reporting, and it just made up for a good team.
It sounds splendid. And I've speaking to David Simon and hearing him talk about his kind of steps into writing TV, which was for Homicidal Life on the Streets, the TV show, and him submitting his first script and then being rewritten to like a fraction of what he'd written. What was it like for your the script that you submitted and what you learned from the feedback you were given from that? What was that process like?
No, I thought it was gonna get gutted like crazy, but like George thought it was good. George thought I did really good. George gave it a read, gave me notes. I went back and fixed it. George gave me some more notes. I went back and fixed it. And then it went to David. And David was like, did you cut loose as much as you wanted to cut loose? And I'm like, I'm not a cowboy. You know what I mean? Like I write nonfiction, but I'm a novelist too. So like a strong arc is extremely important to me. I like to get there with as little, with minimal distractions, especially writing for this new generation of people who watch television like this. If you watch Me on the City, you can't watch Me on the City and be on your phone. I've been at screenings where people was on their phone and I was like, I just had to walk out the room. Like I had to walk out the room so I wouldn't say anything.
It's upsetting, D, when you see people on their phones in the cinema. Because for me, the cinema is like almost like a haven. Where? I go in there to not be distracted.
Absolutely.
And if this some knobhead is next to me with their phone out, I'm like, why are you even here? Why are you even here? You've spent, in like central London, you're spending £20, like $25, $30 to watch this film.
Right.
Just put your phone away for 2 hours.
Just for 2 hours.
Yeah, I can understand if you're there and you're expecting some, I don't know, your wife's maybe going to give birth. Have it on so you can take a call, but don't be out going on Twitter.
right
that shit can definitely wait for 2 hours.
But I think about that, and I know I'm an artist, but I'm also like
consumer.
I'm a professor. I've been a college professor for 8 years now.
Baltimore University, right?
Right, and I teach writing, and I've been teaching long enough to see students who would give a book 10 pages, before they decide to finish it or not, and I've seen that number go down to 3. So I know the attention span is shrinking. So you have to be better. You have to be better. So I think about that a lot.
We in the city, and this is a great reason to talk to you about the writing style here. This is the first time I've seen Blown Deadlines not just forming like a linear narrative, starting at A, going to B, to C, to E. They started at A, went to Z, go to G, go to A again. And if you're not paying attention at all, then you're like, hold on, Wayne's suddenly got a beard now. Where's his beard gone like 2 minutes later? What's happening here? You've got Saw and Suter storyline, which is like, if you're not paying attention, then you're completely lost. So, I mean, what was that like writing for that? Because that's tough writing. a single episode that's like bouncing around timeline, but also fitting the arc of the other six, of the other five.
It's tough writing, but it's for me, the juice is worth the squeeze. Mm. Juice is worth the squeeze because we're building a case, but we weren't necessarily using the police officers, investigating the police officers to build the case in a super intentional way. These guys weren't master, you know, they weren't master detectives. They weren't master, you know, they didn't have the kind of brains to like Daniels and the crew and the Wire. These are different kind of guys who are just following the pieces, and we just kind of wanted you to follow these guys as they stumble upon this empire, which was like, which is the same way you hit the public is the same way we wanted it to hit the viewers. And that's what we tried to do. And with that in mind, it's why we dropped so much, you know, in episode one. It's why we show you that Jenkins goes down in episode one. And then we go back and say, okay, so what made Jenkins Jenkins? And this is what made Jenkins Jenkins. And then this is the world that surrounded that.
I mean, this is what you're talking about, trying to humanize people. We touched on a couple of times here. Wayne Jenkins didn't turn up, even though, you know, I'm not sure why he joined the police force, but he probably didn't think this opportunity would arise to, you know, to take money out of people's pockets as they're walking past and then hit them in the face. You know, he these opportunities were presented to him, and then more and more getting presented to him. And it's interesting to see, like, Saw and Suter, for example, these opportunities were presented to him, and it looks like he turned away from that side of things, but always regretted the times that he did, you know, take some money. And that's ultimately kind of, whichever way you look at it, kind of was the reason he met his end. You feel there's some kind of guilt within Sean. But the way you've humanized people, not villainized, they've done that themselves, but you've kind of said, well, look, that's what happened. He got beaten down by his friends for having the small crabs, you know, opportunities came around, and he thinks, well, I'll just do that. I'll just take the 10K. I'll just take the 20K. And then it becomes, actually, if I can just stumble across these, there must be systems I can put in place. There must be playbooks.
You know what a lot of people don't understand?
Mm.
It's rare for a police officer to see that kind of money and not take it.
Mm.
People think it's the other way around. They think it's rare for a guy to take it. No, it's rare for them to not take it. My whole life, I was taught that to be in certain areas or to come across certain people, you have to pay taxes. To cross that bridge, you got to pay a tax. And they were the tax. Not the taxes on groceries, not the taxes that go to the government for roads and streets, but they were existence tax. You have to pay them. You have to pay them, and it's normalized.
I want to talk. Get back onto the Wire track now. Mm-hmm. So you wrote. So first, but before we go back, so you wrote episode three. I was going to say it's a good episode. They're all great episodes. and we see. You know, Wayne Jenkins is not maybe at the height of his powers, and Saw and Suter's alongside him, and Saw and Suter's great and interesting character in this whole story. But Saw and Suter's he seems like natural police in the way that the other guys maybe aren't, a bit more brains than brawn, and he sees the specially made table as Wayne Jenkins is hitting things up with a blunt tool, baseball bat, whatever he can get his hands on. And Saw and Suter just looks to the side at something and says, that's not right. That's weird, that table. And lo and behold, there's the, you know, hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands of dollars in there, which they just both, you know, take some from. I mean, you talk about the story, just that one scene in particular. What was that like building that scene up? What was the case? What was the intelligence behind that scene in terms of the case? Was evidence before that scene specifically, or was that something you kind of built together as like an example of what could go on?
No, that happened. That actually happened. It happened. It was a car wash, and the guy who owned the car wash was known to be a big time drug dealer. And Jenkins scoped this guy out, and he knew it was money inside that car wash. He knew that guy had a boat. He knew that guy was really, really known around West Baltimore for shaking and moving as far as drugs is concerned. And he wanted some, and him and Sean Suda, they went on that mission. And that was one of the only scenes that I wrote that I had to rewrite multiple times, because when I wrote the scene, I wrote it wild. Like, I wrote Jenkins wild, and like, I wrote Jenkins going out of control, and the lawyers was like, all right, you gotta pull back.
So you had Pelicanos, you had David Simon, and you had the law saying,
yeah, the lawyers,
yeah, you know, giving you notes.
The lawyers was like, you got to pull it back. And the crazy thing is that, again, John Bernthal was excellent actor. Jamie Hector's excellent too. Jamie Hector's brilliant. John Bernthal got this early version of my script, and he's calling me up like late night, and we're on the phone talking it through, and he's like, but I want to do this, can I do this? And I'm like, nah, you should do that. And he like, no, I'm gonna do that. And we're just really, really talking it through, and we're working it through, and we got it. And then it gets to the chopping block, and he was like, I don't want to disrespect you, I don't want to disrespect the team, peace and love, brother. That's the kind of guy John is. Hey, he's peace and love, brother. But you know, I like how we had it, I want to take it back to what we had. And I'm like, yeah, man, but they not gonna let us get sued, man. They gonna protect us. They gonna protect us from getting sued, man. Like, we work horses, John. We don't have time to go to court, man. We don't have time to be sitting down with lawyers, man. So let's just, you know, let's figure out how to make it what we can do it. But yeah, that was a real scene that actually happened. As everything else in the show happened. Like, these things are right from court records, court documents, victim impact statements. Some of the guys caught up in the case, some on the criminal side, you know, I got to them in jail. I wrote them, and I reached out to people on the street to talk to them on the phone so I can know what actually happened, the way from their perspective, because I wanted to be as authentic as possible.
Well, let's get on to the case of the book. As this episode goes out, the Why Retrospective book, which you've written, comes out towards the end of November. And tell us about, you know, that. What's happened? How did that come about? What can we expect? And how can we get hold of that and Black Boy Smile and all your other books as well?
Yeah, all of my books are available. In the States, they're available everywhere books are sold. In the UK, I imagine you can get everything from Amazon. But if your local bookstore doesn't carry them, then, you know, you put some pressure on them. but the Wire book was I didn't know it was coming. They had a guy working on it for a nice amount of time, and from what I'm hearing, he didn't submit some things that everybody involved was comfortable with, so they gave me a shot. And, you know, like I said at the top of the podcast, I've watched The Wire more than most people. I'm a huge fan of the brand. I'm a huge fan of the characters, the people, the writers, the whole team. Like, Nina has like been brilliant. Even Richard Price, people don't give Richard Price enough credit for working on the show. Richard Price, who wrote the book Clockers, is a brilliant writer. All of these people, George, everybody. So when I got an opportunity to just lock in and put my own little perspective on it, I was extremely happy. The team liked what I submitted initially. I didn't have I didn't have a year or so like the other person. I only had like a couple of weeks, but that's, I mean, that's, I've been charged with the task of writing like 60,000 and 70,000 word books in like under a month before. So writing whatever 10,000 words or whatever it was is on top of like what I wrote to go along with some of the images. It wasn't a heavy lift for me.
Well, good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. So what can we expect when it comes out? What kind of form of book is it?
It's an art book. So it'll look really, really beautiful on your coffee table. And you will be able to see never before seen interviews, never before seen perspective, never before seen images from behind the sets. It's going to be a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful gift for anyone who likes The Wire. People who love The Wire are going to try to be your best friend. The people who like it, it'll probably be like the best gift they got all year.
I think we're going to try and do a competition to give away one of these books for people when it comes out live. So guys, if you're not on our social media already, we're at The Wire Stripped on Instagram and Twitter. And that's where we'll let you know about these the book going live. Hopefully with D being able to sign it.
Absolutely. And then you got connect. You know, Laura, make it 5 books. Tell Laura to send 5 books over. Yep. You know, tell her send 5. Let's give away 5 books. Let's make it a party.
So tell me about some of your favorite themes, seasons, scenes, actors, people, whatever about The Wire. How many, you know, in the multiple times you've watched it, what if someone says The Wire, what comes to your mind like straight away? And you can spoil anything, right?
I'm so tore because season one was so different. And I grew up in a building, East Baltimore, not West Baltimore, but it looks just like what they call the towers, housing projects. And it was nostalgia for me watching it. My good friend, my really, really good friend, Andre Poole, who's Silk, played in season 1. This is the guy I grew up under who taught me how to play basketball. He was the guy in the basketball game who they brung in.
All right.
Yeah, he was the ringer who they brung in to like when East Baltimore beat West Baltimore. So like that was like a big moment when I found out Silk did that. Season 4 might be my favorite of all time. Season 4, they was just on another level. The writing, the acting, you know. But then I love season 3 as well. It's just such a, I also, you know, and unpopular to a lot, but I love season 2. Season 2 was good. Like season 2 was like extremely important just to show like how these things make it into the city, how there's a whole other Baltimore that doesn't make it into the conversation, and how, you know, how diverse and how wild this argument is. So I'm the worst person to ask that question, but if I had to pick one, I'll say season 4, because the school system is a lot. It's a lot. We have in Baltimore right now, we started this year with a shortage of about 800 teachers. So the stuff you see, the stuff people seen over a decade ago, still going on right now. It's still happening right now. And Wire held a mirror up to how ugly society is. And it created a lot of change makers, but then at the same time, it made a whole lot of people run. and that's what great art does. Great art creates change, or it makes people run, and we got to continue to create great art.
I think it's hard. It is always a hard question. Season 2, you brought in there. My theory, season 2 is, people who don't like season 2 have only seen The Wire once, and they've gone, season 2 is a bit strange. But then on that revisit, and I was one of those people, but on that revisit, that's when people say, oh, I get it now. I get how season 2 is important to link to the rest of, you know, The Wire on that second time.
It was good. It was good. It was real good, man. Avon set the cop up, I think that was in season 2. That was good, man. That was good. When he set the cop up, that was good. The CO, he set up the CO. That's how he was free. He got free.
The correction officer, yeah.
Yeah, he got free because he set the correctional officer up. That was good writing.
It's been a pleasure to hear about how The Wire is probably positively affected you more than anyone else in the world, I'd say.
Yeah, absolutely. I work with them now.
Yeah. These guys are your friends.
Right.
Yeah. Where can people find you online, D?
At D Watkins World on all social media.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, man. Peace.
Right, so that is takes us to the end of this episode. That was a great interview. Kobe mentioned up top that we will be giving away some signed copies of that book. Just as a reminder, it's The Wire, The Complete Visual History. So if you head over to our social pages, we're going to have the details up there on how to enter. So that's at The Wire Stripped on Twitter and Instagram.
That's right, yeah. And also, do look out for D Watkins. Go to Amazon, type his name in, D, as in letter D, Watkins, because he's got some other books as well. And hey, why not buy them as well?
Buy all his books. Loads of books.
Exactly.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.